with your permission, I think what would be more, we'd get more out of would be to make this a discussion, or maybe question and answer, rather than a talk. But first I'll tell you a few ideas about depression, the Jewish attitude towards the situation of a woman who's lost her husband, depression in general, how those two come together, what should be one's attitude from a Jewish point of view. And then using some of those ideas, you are free to, you don't have to agree with me, you may have some of your own experiences to share, disagree, ask questions, that's fine. If I'm able to, then I'll certainly try and answer. There are many, many things that have to be said. I think the first thing that a person has to know is that depression is never allowed. I'm not going to give you here a medical discussion about, you know, the signs and symptoms of depression. It's one of those things that you have to know about it. The medical technical side here, I think, only has one aspect that I'd like to mention briefly, and that is just simply the following point. That, as I'm sure you're aware, probably as well as I am, there are two kinds of depression generally that the medical world recognizes. I'm sure you're aware of this. One they call exogenous and one they call endogenous. The difference between these is very, very broadly as follows. That an exogenous depression is a kind of depression that a person enters because of something external to themselves, like a situation. Having lost a marriage partner or someone close in the family, the normal consequence of that is a tendency towards depression. It does not imply any mental illness. On the contrary, that's a normal response to a situation. So it happens it's not allowed in Jewish terms. I'm trying to discuss this. You might be surprised to hear this. But nevertheless, it's a normal function or response, and it doesn't imply any mental imbalance or abnormal process. However, the other kind of depression is called endogenous depression, which means that it's in and of yourself. That there's a chemical imbalance, let's call it, or some genetic predisposition. It's not yet understood what are the technical, chemical, or physical factors that give rise to the situation. And there you can get a situation where a person can be very depressed, and that often happens in the absence of any cause at all. It can start in childhood even, can start certainly in a teenage year. This kind of depression is not linked to a situation that happens in life. Why it's important to make this distinction in terms of our understanding is as follows. Because the two are amenable to different types of treatment. That means, and again this is going to be complicated because there's a crossover. Even exogenous depression, which means a person who's gone through a life experience that has left them depressed, sometimes that can be significantly helped by drug therapy. And drug therapy shouldn't be scorned. There's nothing wrong from a Jewish point of view. In fact, it would be an obligation, if that could help one, to engage in such therapy if necessary. On the other hand, endogenous depression, this chemical or physical, let's call it, imbalance, is amenable often to certain forms of drug therapy, but also may be amenable to the other kind of techniques, which I'll discuss, which can help a person who has the other kind of depression. Are you with me? So it's a mixed bag, and each of them has to be understood in terms of the other. I'm only mentioning all this for one reason, and that is a person who thinks that they have a reason to be depressed because of a life change, like having lost someone in a family or in the marriage, might in fact have an underlying chemical or medical cause for their depression, and may be ignoring that. Are you with me? Because they think that they're depressed because this and this has happened to them, and therefore they're going to struggle on, and actually they could be markedly helped by the technical medical approach which might help the other kind of depression. This is a very complicated situation because the fact that a person may be helped by a drug, let's say, is no proof that they have this chemical or physical or whatever you want to call it imbalance, because the other kind of depression is also often amenable to being helped by drug therapy. It's a very, very complex situation. And therefore, if you want to know a general map out of the woods in this situation, if a person is feeling depressed, I think a reasonable way to go about it, in my humble opinion, you're not forced to accept my opinion, neither medical nor Jewish or anything else, but my humble opinion would be that the way a person should approach it is that they should first attempt the non-medical approach to this thing. That means they should seek Jewish advice, nechama type of situation that could help a person and raise some of the issues that could help a person clarify their own situation. And if that fails, or if a person feels that having done all that's possible and necessary in that field, the person still needs medical help, then a person could seek out medical, drug-related, or other technical medical modalities that might help them. I would strongly suggest that even if a person gets to that stage, they should seek Jewish advice as to which medical line they should take. Because unfortunately, and I don't want to get into any controversial areas here, the people who deal in this area are psychiatrists. And psychiatrists, unfortunately, often do not function according to a Jewish model. We're not passing any blame, we're not apportioning blame to anyone, but that is the medical model. It does not have the same moral Jewish underpinnings that we would like necessarily. And therefore, if a person gives themselves into a system that's not based on authentic Jewish and Torah values, so a person might achieve possibly a short-term benefit, but you might be doing damage that's not permitted. And therefore, a person should seek somebody in the medical field who is aware of what the Jewish approach should be. And that's obvious information that doesn't only apply to depression. There's another reason that I think this should be the order, and that is because medical treatment has side effects. Jewish treatment doesn't have any bad side effects. Jewish treatment, which is taking yourself in hand and working out certain things the way you can work them out, will only have good side effects. Whereas medical treatment often has negative side effects. And therefore, if one can achieve whatever benefit or improvement one can before one goes into the medical or drug-related field, obviously that makes sense. And there are other reasons too. Now, let's look at it from a Jewish point of view. What we're going to do now, with your permission, is exclude that side of depression which is, let's call it medical, for want of a better word. Okay, technical, chemical, etc. This could have happened to a person before they lost their husband, wife, or close member of family, whatever it is. You might have had that beforehand and be having an exacerbation of it because of the mixture of causes now. But this is not the place to discuss that technical subject. You can get somebody who's better qualified than I am, and you can discuss the medical side and the drug therapy and so forth of depression. I don't think that's our job this morning. So we'll relate ourselves to the other aspect of depression, which is the functional side, the side that's natural and normal that a person responds with in this kind of situation or other kind of life traumas. I'll just make one final comment. Bear in mind while we're saying this, if you happen to be a person who has a tendency to, let's call it the chemical or metabolic kind of depression, or you know someone in that field, this advice and what we'll discuss this morning is very relevant to that also. It might be enough even in such a situation. Could be a person with that kind of, let's call it illness, could also cope perfectly adequately sometimes, simply with the Jewish approach, even without drugs, could be. But we are specifically speaking this morning about the response to a situation that causes depression. Now let's try and look at that briefly from a Jewish point of view. That the first thing a person should know is that it's not allowed. It's not allowed. They're not allowed to be depressed. The Jewish attitude is that sadness and mourning is a natural process. That's not only allowed, it's a mitzvah. When a person goes through an experience where mourning is called for, then one is required to mourn, even if it's a situation where one might not feel like it. But there's a mitzvah to do it. You have to sit on a low place, and you have to spend 7 days, and you have to go through a certain process, 7 days, and even in the case of a husband, it extends to 30 days in certain details. That's what one has to do. That's a mitzvah. And sadness and crying is what has to be done. And it says the first 3 days are for crying, 7 days are for the crying, and the second four for certain other things. But that has to be done. That's certainly allowed. But depression, which is that non-functional, despairing feeling that life's come to an end, or that, you know, I'm not going to make any progress, or there's nothing left to live for, and that grinding to a halt of one's inner life, that we call depression, that's not allowed. I didn't say it's easy. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying there are many mitzvahs that are difficult to do. I'm not claiming it's easy. But the aim in such a situation is to try and work on oneself to a point where one does not experience that. Again, there's a time for sadness. That doesn't have to be excluded, and it can't be excluded. And when it's yahrzeit, or when it's shiva, yahrzeit, whatever it is, or appropriate times, then there's a time for sadness. And like it says in Koheles, says King Shlomo says that there's a time for everything. Time for sadness, time for happiness. But depression, which is that, again, that grinding to a halt, that despairing feeling, however you define it, that's to be avoided. The Chazon Ish says that if a person would understand what life's about in essence correctly, that means the connection between this life and the next, then one would never be sad at all. One would always be happy. Even in the face of tragedy, one would be happy. Well, that's an unreal saintly level to achieve, but one should have that in front of one's eyes. Now, let's try and understand one or two mechanisms. How can one achieve this? It's all very well to say it's not allowed, and that one should never allow oneself to slip into that mode, but how exactly do you do that? There was a great Hasidic thinker who said the following thing, a remarkable thing. He said, you find things that are better than any mitzvah in the Torah and worse than any avera, than any sin. What's better than any mitzvah? He said, are going to the mikveh. He was talking about men, let alone women. But the purity that you get from immersion in a mikveh could be better than a mitzvah. Why? Because although not a mitzvah for a man, but it could lift him to a state of spiritual, let's say, inspiration that he could do achieve what he's supposed to achieve, or a woman. Let's say, in this case, he was talking about a man. Achieve what a person's supposed to achieve in the world. That's a wonderful thing. But what interests us this morning is the other side. He said, what is it that's worse than an avera? What could be that's worse than a sin that the Torah prohibits? Depression. Even though you won't find thou shalt not be depressed, doesn't say anywhere in the Torah that's prohibited to be depressed. Doesn't say that openly like a sin, like stealing. But nevertheless, despite not being explicitly prohibited, he said it's worse than any sin. Because what it leads to is the worst things. It leads to a complete nullification of what a person's supposed to be doing in the world. When a person reaches a stage in life when they no longer have a spouse with whom they might have had a very close relationship, from a Jewish point of view, that is absolutely no excuse to stop living. Or to stop achieving. On the contrary, a person has to achieve every day more than they achieved the day before, and this situation doesn't change that. And if depression would stop a person achieving what they're supposed to be achieving in the world, so that would be terrible. Apart from the worst consequences that a person can become, have suicidal thoughts, chas v'sholom, and so forth, come to bigger destruction. Therefore, it's something very strenuously to deal with. Now let's understand what are the mechanisms of this. The first thing is to understand the following spiritual point. This has been recorded from the beginning, so you can always get a copy of this, because you'll miss important information there. And we'll copy it for you. You might as well have it complete. Please sit now. I won't continue unless you're sitting comfortably. Is that chair, please? Okay, the first thing to understand is this. And we'll have to weave two things together here. That there's a natural spiritual pathway in such an event that happens in one's life, that if one can ride the wave of it, one can have tremendous help. Again, let's understand. The spiritual world is built in such a way that if you know how to ride the wave, go with what the events of the times in one's life are bringing, then instead of fighting against the world, one can be using what's happening in the world. Try and understand this spiritually. I'm sure you're aware of it, that often what one experiences in a depression is the frustration of fighting against the impossible. In fact, it could be sometimes that that's the worst aspect of it, that you're pounding against the situation that's impossible, really hoping and trying somehow in a futile way, the back of your mind, to somehow one day change it. And yet carrying with you the awareness that you actually can't change it. It's a terrible frustration, that. Are you with me? From a Jewish point of view, we don't look at it that way. We try to ride the experience as it is flowing, so that instead of fighting against the experience, you get helped by the experience. Sounds strange. Let's understand. There's an amazing thing that says that, the place in Chazal that says this, that when the Mashiach arrives, when the Messiah, when the Messianic revelation occurs, so it says like this, V'softa ha'aretz mishpachas mishpachas, that the Jewish world will mourn and cry in families. Families will get together and cry. That's what will happen. After the Mashiach arrives, that incredible explosion of spiritual revelation, when the world enters a stage of tremendous spiritual happiness, the first thing that will happen is that Jewish families will get together and cry. That's a very strange thing. After all, the Messianic revelation is always likened in the spiritual sources to being the birth of a child. So why is it that there's crying? So Chazal explained it like this. So hear this carefully, it's a wonderful, sensitive and subtle, beautiful idea. Is that while we're alive in this phase of existence, what's happened has we've been desensitized. We are desensitized, we don't feel experiences the way we should. we actually don't feel life, the happiness and the sadness, the way we should. What we have, it says in the sources, is that we have a heart of stone. We have a stone heart. But it says that when the Mashiach arrives and that messianic phase is about to be ushered in, so Hashem says, I will take out of you the heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. So the idea behind it is explained as follows. Why do you have a heart of stone now? Why do we have a heart of stone? So I heard a very great man, Yishalayim, explain it this way. The reason Hashem gives us a heart of stone is because we couldn't survive otherwise. If you really felt the sadness, if you really felt the sadness of an event in life that is unchangeable and sad, you wouldn't be able to survive. You wouldn't be able to continue. The power and the weight of the depression would be so great that a person couldn't continue. So Hashem takes away your sensitivity. It gives you a heart of stone so that you can function. The man who told this to me gave me the example that he was close to because he was familiar with it, was the case of the Ponovitch Arov. The Ponovitch Arov was a man who lost his whole family during the Holocaust. His wife and 10 children. And he survived. What did he do after that? He built Ponovitch Yeshiva, which was a Herculean effort of building one of the world's great Torah centers, almost single-handed, to become one of the greatest, one of those institutions, maybe at the center of them, that carried over the Torah tradition from the last generation that was destroyed into this generation and been responsible for seeing it come alive again. So this rabbi, Simcha Wasserman, happens to be the one who put it to me. Leonora is 91 today. He said the following thing, that had the Ponovitch Arov felt what had happened to him, had he been able to absorb it, had he had a heart of flesh, he's talking about a very great man, had he been able to absorb it and feel it in a genuine human way, he would have been paralyzed with pain. But because Hashem does you the kindness of, as time goes on, hardening your heart, so you're able to function. Nobody says you feel happy about it. Nobody said it's easy. But it gives you the little kick that you need into, as time goes by, making the pain just bearable enough that you can function. But when the Mashiach comes, and there's nothing that you have to, there's no more a need to struggle against frustration. When the world reveals itself, when spiritually everything's there as it should be, when the people who've been lost will arise again, when a person who's lost a husband will be together again with that person. That's our belief in Tchias Amasim, that you'll see the person, you'll be together again. Or children that never, lo yalanu, were lost. Even miscarriages and so forth, they'll all be there. The person will be together with their whole family. You won't have to have the spiritual battle against the unassailable odds anymore. So then Hashem will be able to give you back a heart of flesh, and that's when the crying will begin. That's when the crying will begin. Now when you'll be allowed, when you'll be able to feel all the emotions as they should be, and where you might as well be human again, then that's when the crying will begin. And then a person will cry through that stage, and then the happiness will come. Some of the commentaries say it's like a person who's been separated from someone for a long time, an old, long-lost friend or family member that you've been separated with for a long time. And you look with tremendous anticipation towards meeting them. And what happens? When they get off the plane, you throw each other into each other's arms and you start howling. But it's the happiest moment here. You've been separated for years and you cry. That's the way we function. That's how we function. You guard against the emotion. You have this mechanism that guards against it while you're apart. When you meet again, the first thing that happens is not happiness. But they are very amazing kind of tears, those. They're tears of sadness. They're tears, but they're tears of happiness. And after a person goes through the crying, then you get to the situation of normality and happiness. Now let's look at this phenomenon just a bit deeper. This hardening of the heart, or this ability to withstand, to continue to function in this kind of pain, that has to be understood. What has to be understood carefully is this. A person should not think that they are, you see, many people harbor a guilt that they're insensitive. Many people harbor a guilt that after a year or two have gone by, they no longer feel the pain as acutely as they did, then they harbor a guilt that they are not sensitive anymore, and they feel that it's letting down the person, the husband, or person who's no longer alive, in that they don't feel the pain anymore as much as they did. Some people feel guilty because of that. You should know, and I'm not going to go into this in detail, people feel guilty about many things, and this often makes it worse. Sometimes people feel guilty because the relationship wasn't as good as it should have been. And therefore they feel that they never really fixed it up or corrected it. That's a potent source of depression and anger. sometimes a person can feel worse after that than if they lost someone with whom they had a very good relationship, even though there's a greater loss in a sense over there. All these complications arise. But when a person finds that they're becoming less sensitive and they don't cry as much, sometimes they feel that maybe they are incorrectly. A person should know that spiritually the world has been created that way. That it's a natural process that as time goes by, a person is supposed to become less sensitive in that way. But the positive side is that you're supposed to get busy. Not just that you don't feel the pain anymore, so now you can grind to a halt now without pain. That's not the point. The point is, as I try to explain, you stop feeling the pain so you can get busy and pick yourself up and do what you're supposed to be doing in the world. A woman who has, let's say, maturity. Maybe she lost her husband at a stage where she's already older. I'm not saying old. There's no such thing. But older. So she has maturity. So a tremendous amount to teach. Tremendous amount to teach. You've got to get busy doing it. South African Jewish women who are, let's say, over the age of, let's say, approximately, arbitrarily, let's say 50, have an incredible advantage that they come from a generation that was normal. This generation is not normal. This generation of youth are no longer normal. People who fit into my parents' generation and previous, let's say, from roughly speaking that generation back, were brought up in a society that was normal. Even Jews who did not keep Torah and mitzvahs actively. That means even South African Jews who didn't study Torah and didn't keep mitzvahs actively, but they were normal. That means their heart was in the right place. Their word was their word. Is that correct? What person of that generation ever let anyone down? Or ever broke his word? Or ever let anyone down in business? Or didn't do anything less than the maximum sacrifice for their children? It was normal. And if you try and speak to people of that generation about it and try and explain your admiration for it, they think you're crazy, because what else is there in life? But this generation doesn't function that way. This generation doesn't have a first clue about what it means, responsibility or reliability, or sticking with your word, or living up to what you said. The divorce rate now in Johannesburg is over 50% among Jewish families. More than half. That means here's a man who stood under the chuppah, and he promised this woman that he would be with her through thick and thin, no matter what, and so forth and so on. 3 months later, in these days, many divorces are taking place in the first year of marriage. The whole thing just dissolves. I mean, there wasn't a commitment in the first place. The whole idea of a commitment and responsibility disappeared from this generation. But people who still connect to a previous generation have got so much to teach. Just being a tower of strength and dignity, of showing how one carries a situation where one has to struggle with someone's own emotions and one still has that elegance and dignity. That's a tremendous inspiration to a shattered generation. But that alone is a work that a person has to carry on doing. And there's so many who talk all day about what a person who has some degree of maturity, who's been through some of life's experiences, can teach children and grandchildren. And the Jewish community in general. Apart from chesed work that a person can do. I mean, so many things, but that's one's obligation. That's one's obligation. On the contrary, one's now freed of certain obligations in marriage or little children that one doesn't have anymore. But you have to pick yourself up and get busy. So when the emotions tail off and when one's able to function a little bit better, the reason for being given that is so you can function. The Bonavitcher Rov used it to build Bonavitcher Shiva. But a woman who's in that situation has to use it to build what can be built in the world. It so happens, and we'll try and talk about it, that the most potent cure for depression is to get busy. So happens. Not just that it's your obligation, it's also your treatment and your cure. So let's understand. Let's trace this pathway. So in the mystical writings it says the following thing, and what I'm going to tell you now, I personally find the biggest comfort, okay, when I went through my own experience of a loss, people I've spoken to, this is one of the greatest comforts that a person has to know. And it's as follows. And I'm not going to go into it in detail because people think it's specs of spiritualism and so forth, which is forbidden. But what pays is to know the spiritual pathway. What does the soul of a person undergo when they leave this world, and how are they connected to you? You see, if you could know what that person's going through and how they're connected to you, it's a tremendous source of comfort. Part of the pain is the separation and the vagueness about not knowing exactly what's going on. Are they? Do they exist? Don't they exist? Do they know what's with me? Or don't they? These are questions that are very important, a tremendous comfort to people, especially if you are going to become people who work with others. You have to be able to convey, or at least steer people to the correct places where they can find out this information. And just to take one dimension of it, let me explain the following idea. That what we described as the pathway where one's emotions gradually adjust to the situation, in certain mystical sources, it's explained as follows. It's the most wonderful idea to know. The reason one's emotions change, listen carefully now, the reason that one's emotions change
are not just because time heals wounds. People have the wrong idea. They think as time goes by, so you forget. That's a special creation that Hashem put into the world, that He lessens the pain and makes you forget. That's true. There's a much, much deeper aspect to it. Do you know why your emotions have root? Do you know why your emotions change? Because as the person who's no longer alive goes through changes in the spiritual world, you connect it to them. And as their experience becomes easier in the spiritual world, you feel less pain. I don't know if you're aware of that. Try and explain. It says that, for example, when a person dies, we are that. So until the funeral, between the time that they are nectar, until the levite, between the passing away and the funeral, that's a very agonizing time. It's a very agonizing time. It's so painful that it's a very unusual time. Halachically speaking, a person has no mitzvah there. You are free of mitzvahs. I don't know if you know that. You don't make brochas, man doesn't wear tzitzit. You don't do mitzvahs there. You are paralyzed into inactivity. There's only one thing you have to do, take care that the person should be buried correctly. But it's a time of tremendous disorientation. It's got a special name in it. As soon as the levaya takes place, as soon as the person's laid to rest, there's a tremendous sense of peace. There's a change from the turmoil of the first kind of emotion to a different kind. Usually that's when people start feeling sad. What happens in the first phase is people feel tremendous frustration, turmoil, agitation, anxiety, and then suddenly things sink in and they feel sad at that time. After that, during the 7 days, there's a subtle change that takes place after the first 3 days, and then after the end of the 7 days, and 30 days later there's another change, and after a year there's another change, and then gradually. So the mystics explain like this. What happens during those first hours and days? What happens to the soul, to the soul, the neshama of the person? What is happening to that person who's not alive anymore? If you understand what's happening to the person, you understand what's happening to your emotions. It says this. You don't mind talking about this? When a person is not alive anymore, the first thing that happens is that their soul, the neshama, their consciousness, goes through a tremendous stage of turmoil. Because they don't know where they belong. Imagine being slipped out of your body and being conscious and not being able to do anything. That's what they experience. It's a very, very strange situation. Can you imagine? The person is lifted out of their body, the body won't function. So they try to communicate or speak or act or do and nothing responds. So the neshama flies around in the spiritual world, we're using abstract, borrowed language here, in order to try and find where it actually belongs, and it can't find a place to settle, as it were. We're talking spiritually. So it hovers over the body of the person, and it can't find rest. Then the mystics say that after, and by the way, that's one of the reasons that we try and perform the funeral as soon as possible. One of the reasons that we do it as soon as possible. Because the person is brought to rest. It's not as, people think it's a, what do you call it? Yes, and a sentimental idea, you know, we're brought to rest, you know, the person's resting. Spiritually it's correct. When a person's brought into contact with the earth again, then what happens is the neshama finds a certain degree of rest that it didn't have before, and the turmoil ceases. And your turmoil ceases. Amazing thing. Then it says for the next 7 days, the neshama tries to find where it belongs. And it hovers between the grave and the home. I don't know if you know that. It goes between the graveside and the home, trying to find where it actually belongs. It sort of knows it sort of belongs in the grave, because there's a mystical concept of a life energy that hovers around the person where they buried. And that continues, by the way. It continues. I'm not saying one should go there. Possibly one shouldn't go there. That's a question that has to be discussed separately. Whether one should or shouldn't go there. But anyway, it hovers around there, but also tries to go to the home. That's why there's certain laws about Shiva in the house where the person lived, specifically. And it spends 7 days, 3 days, 7 days trying to sort of find, are you with me? And your emotions go through upheavals connected to that person's neshama. Especially husband and wife. I'm trying to explain that also. After 7 days it says that the neshama finds where it's supposed to be. And it settles into a situation where it rests relative to what it was before. For 30 days that period extends, and after that it becomes comfortable with where it's supposed to be in terms of its, again we're using very crude language, but you know, unrefined spiritual, but that's what it is. And then a year later there is another kind of a change, which is a different issue entirely, and that is that a different kind of an issue, and that is we understand that in the next world people have to go through a certain kind of experience to work out mistakes that they made while they were here, certain kind of corrections, and that could take up to a year. We don't actually believe that anyone needs it for a full year. That's why we say Kaddish only for 11 months. But actually, specifically, if you really want to know, it's really 30 days. Actually, the mourning period for someone who's no longer alive is 30 days long. The only reason that it's a year for parents is a special mitzvah of honor to parents. I don't know if you're aware of that. But for husband and wife, it's not because you feel any less close or because you have any less appreciation. It's not that at all. It's because the period spiritually is 30 days. The year is a different issue. So, are you with me? The principle is that as the neshama goes through these changes, you are dragged. Your neshama is connected to that person. And so you go through certain things. There's a wonderful place where some of the sages explain that when Yosef, remember when Joseph was taken away from his father, it says that Yaakov, his father, mourned for 22 years. He mourned for 22 years. He didn't see him for 22 years until they met again in Egypt. You remember the story? And it happens to be, if you work it out, 22 years that he mourned. Some of the commentaries say that he mourned with the agony of the acute phase of mourning. In other words, he spent 22 years like a person does in the 7 days of Shiva. He couldn't, you follow? He couldn't get over it. He couldn't get over it to the extent that he agonized as if he had just lost his son for 22 years. So the mystical commentaries explain, you know why? Because normally the reason that you settle down and come to terms and find peace is because the neshama is finding peace. But here, Yosef hadn't died, you follow? He was alive in Egypt. So the normal spiritual pathway was not being experienced. So Yaakov, as his father, couldn't experience the normal path. You follow? It's a beautiful idea. So he was caught in that situation of uncertainty and agony. And what's the message of all this? That when this happens to a person, one has to know with a definite and certain faith, emunah, that this person is going through certain experiences that they have to go through. And that you are together with that person in that experience. And that's why the emotions go the way they go. And when a person reaches a situation where they feel a peace that they didn't have before, they don't feel guilty. That's a wonderful thing. That means, in a certain spiritual sense, that the person has reached a certain situation of peace, relatively. There's a judgment every year as well. The outside is a time when a person fasts, do certain things for the neshama of the other person. That's one idea. Now, let me mention one or two other things. Connected. Husband and wife. I don't know if you're aware, but in the spiritual world, husband and wife are considered as a unit. Are you aware of that? This is a first marriage. I'm talking about a first marriage. Second marriage got different rules. A second marriage got other rules in many other ways. Sometimes it's more successful than a first marriage because persons are older and they appreciate sometimes what they didn't appreciate before. But spiritually, it says that in Shemaim, in the spiritual dimension, when a child is conceived, around that time a voice goes out and designates who that person will marry. Which means that the person that one married was actually designated and destined spirited. Are you aware of that idea? Which means that you were connected spiritually from before you even met each other. And mystically, there's a connection between you that exists forever. Forever. All relatives, by the way. All relatives. Children are not alive as well. Never disconnected from a person. But husband and wife form a special spiritual bond. And there are places that say that in the next world, there's a Gemara that says that in the next world, a person lives individually. That means you don't live bonded to others, you live as yourself. Which means your own consciousness and what you worked on yourself in life. And the level you got to, that is how you exist in the next world. But there's one exception. Husband and wife exist as one bond. It's one unit. Some people, that's not such good news. Depends how the relationship works. But nevertheless. And it could be that one of the pair could be responsible for saving the other one spiritually. If one of the pair was a person who worked hard on themselves during life, even if the other one wasn't as deserving, but Hashem wouldn't do it to the one who does deserve. Reb Chaim Sonnenfeld, one of the great Gedolim of the last generation, once he said the following thing about himself. Once somebody said he was a big tzaddik, a big righteous individual. Definitely he had a share in the world to come. So he was very embarrassed about this, but he said the following thing. He said, you know what, I probably do have a share in the world to come. So the person said, you know, you don't hear people speaking that way. Who can be confident that they really have a merit to share in the world to come? So he said that he feels he does have a share in the world to come. So they said to him, why? How do you know? So he answered the following answer. He said, me, myself, I certainly don't deserve a share in the world to come. I'm a nobody. I haven't worked on myself. I'm a nothing. But my wife is such a tzaddikus. She's such a saintly individual. For her, definitely, She definitely merits a share in the world to come. And they'd never do it to her. They wouldn't do that to her. They wouldn't put her there and not let me be with her. You know that? She doesn't deserve that. So fortunately, I married a woman who's going to schlep me in. That's what he said about it. But you see, from this idea, the serious side of it is that the two neshamas are intimately connected. They are connected. They were connected before you met each other. They connected during life in marriage. It's got nothing to do with whether a relationship's good or not. There are exceptions, by the way. I'm not going to go into that. There are certain marriages that are not the ones that were destined beforehand. But I'm not going to go into that. Then the person is connected when one is left behind in this world and the other person is in that spiritual world that's called Olam HaNeshamos. In that world, they are still connected. They'll be connected again in Tshuva HaMaasim when they live together again, physically, and forever in the eternal world that's called Olam HaBa, then the neshamas will still be connected. That's a very important fact that the person has to know. Now let's extend this one step further and then perhaps if there are questions, I just keep talking all day. But if there are questions, perhaps let's try and... Just one more fact that a person has to know. And that's as follows. There's one way in which a person's connected to someone who's no longer alive that's an obligation to know about. That's a very, very important fact. Okay? It's like this. This applies most specifically between parents and children, when a child has a parent who's no longer alive. But it connects to anybody, it's relevant to anybody with whom one was close. Listen well to this because it's a critically important idea. When somebody's not in the world anymore, that a person, and they leave behind someone who is, so the mystics, the Gemara talks about it clearly, clear aspect of Jewish belief, is that what you do affects them. Let's understand this very carefully. What you do when you're left behind affects that person immediately and directly. You are not allowed to sit back and say, well, they've got their own cheshbon up there, they're floating along the way, Hashem's dealing with them, and I'm free to do what I want to do. You can't do that. You carry full responsibility for them in a way that you never did before. To understand this well. When a person's in the world and you're responsible for them in a relationship, you have to behave correctly towards them. But when they're no longer in the world, they can't do anything for themselves. The only way they can change spiritually is what you do for them. Are you with me? And they go up or down in the spiritual world according to how you live your life in this world. Try and understand this idea. We have the following concept, very briefly. We understand that when a person's in this world, the disadvantage of this world is that it's a lowly place full of pain. But the advantage of this world, and the reason you're here, is that everything you do makes a difference. When you take your hand, you put it in your pocket, you take out a few coins and give it to somebody who doesn't have, you're doing a physical action in the world that has consequences for eternity. You're translating a physical action into a spiritual world. When you enter that spiritual world, you become that thing. They don't hand out reward over... When a person enters the spiritual world in the next world, they don't hand out reward for what you did here. You follow me? They don't give you reward for what you did. You are the reward. What you did, every time you bit your tongue and didn't say an angry word, and you controlled yourself, and you behaved with wisdom and kindliness and sensitivity, that is what you are in the next world. Are you with me? You don't get rewarded. You experience it. You are that. That's all you are in the next world. The downside of the next world, the positive side of the next world, is that you experience the beauty of what it was that you worked on yourself to become. And you experience closeness to Hashem. There's no pain. But the downside, the negative side, is that you can't do anything for yourself anymore. In the next world, you would love to be able to give a few pennies to somebody who needs it, but you can't, you don't have a hand to do it with. Are you with me? That's the sadness of the next world. Which means that the great pain of the next world, if you want to call it that, is if you didn't work on yourself to the maximum, and now you'd like to try and you can't anymore, your chances are over. There's one exception. If you left behind somebody in this world who does it for you, you change there. Now let's understand why. Are you with me? I'm sorry to have to tell you this. It puts a lot of responsibility on your shoulders. I'll tell you why. Listen carefully now. It's perfectly logical. Let's take the example of a parent and a child. Okay, that's where it's sharpest. But it can be any Jew. But a parent and a child. Listen carefully. It says that on Rosh Hashanah, when a person dies, you know this, it says an amazing thing. On Rosh Hashanah, the books of the living and the dead are opened. That's what it says. The people who are alive are judged, and the people who are not alive are judged every Rosh Hashanah. So some of the commentaries ask the following question. What's the point of judging the people who are not alive anymore? What did they do different this year? They didn't do anything. You follow me? Here's a person who died this Rosh Hashanah, before Rosh Hashanah. So they go up into the next world, they're judged. They're given their level, they exist like that. Next Rosh Hashanah, you judge them again.
What did they do during the year? They weren't on the, in the earth, in the world, on earth. They were in the spiritual. What possible change? You follow the question. Why judge them again every year? There are a number of mystical answers which I'm not going to go into now. But there's one answer that we have to know. Oh yes, they are different. They're very different this year than they were last year. Do you know why? Listen to this. Amazing thing. Do you know every year when you get judged while you're alive, you know what you're getting judged for? You're getting judged for every action you did during the year. Right? Every time you controlled yourself and you functioned at a better level and you showed more dignity, sensitivity, whatever, you get reward. Every time you allowed yourself to slip and you let yourself go, you get the damage of that action. But you know what? You're not only judged for that. You're judged for all the consequences of your actions. Let me give you an example. Let's say you wake up in the morning, you walk out and you meet a friend of yours. And you decide to lift yourself to a level through sheer self-control and determination, and you smile. That person is injected with a little bit of happiness that day that they wouldn't have had otherwise. What do? They treat their children or whoever it is in a slightly different way. You follow? There's one thing they would have said that they don't say now because of your smile. Those people are now affected. You follow? Do you know how far one word that you say could go? You follow me? Let's say you become an example. You do something that's unexpected that you really show you're an example of. And your children get inspired by that. They could be a different kind of parents to their children because of that one thing that they remember that you did. So millions of people could be affected. You follow what's happening? When you do one thing, it ripples out into the world. You walk around like a misery. Everybody around you becomes a misery. People avoid you. The whole world that surrounds you, the vibe, the spiritual energy starts dropping. Tangibly. And that has an effect on the next level. And the whole world eventually is affected. Are you with me? Everything you do, when you judge, you're not only judged for what you did, you judge for all the consequences because you set them into motion. You're fully responsible. If there's somebody, someplace, the other side of the earth, who's now having a miserable day, you follow, because you did something back here that you shouldn't have done, you're accountable for that, to the extent that you're accountable. Are you with me? So now listen to this. When a person leaves the world, what happens is this. They leave the world and they get judged immediately. It says there's a certain kind of judgment that a person goes through. Next Rosh Hashanah, they haven't done anything. But you know what's happened? Millions of things have happened in the world as a consequence of their life. And they are accountable. You follow that? Here's a person who dies. Then this person, next Rosh Hashanah, what has happened during the year? Everything their children have done. Everything that their children have done is attributable to them. Because those children are in the world because they put them in the world. So it accrues to their credit. And if the children live negatively, it's to their debit. Especially if the child lived negatively because the parent taught them something negative. And if the child lived positively and did a mitzvah because the parent inspired them, the credit goes to the parent. Of course, the child also gets the credit. Do you follow what's happening? So every year that a person's not in the world, everything that's playing itself out in the world builds to the credit or debit of the person who's not here because they set it in motion. Are you with me? Now, how we use this idea is as follows. That's your responsibility. When somebody's no longer alive and they're in the spiritual world and you are here, what you're doing now because of what you were inspired to by knowing them accrues to their credit. When a child does a mitzvah or says Kaddish or does a mitzvah or does anything positive because they're in the world because the parent put them or because they were inspired by that parent's sensitivity, warmth, love, whatever it was, or they treat their children a certain way because they remember how their parent treated them, the parent gets the credit because they're responsible for having taught that thing. And therefore, you better act correctly. You better be a merit. You better shoulder the responsibility, and you better do. And that's why we have this thing in Judaism that we dedicate what we do to people who are not alive anymore. It's not sentimental. You know, we dedicate books in yeshivas. We give tzedakah. We do things that we dedicate to ilu nishmas. That means to the elevation of the neshama of the person. Not a sentimental act. There's nothing sentimental in Judaism. Just sort of remember them. It couldn't be more direct. You're affecting them directly. When you go out and do a mitzvah, and you do it because of my parent is not alive anymore. What happens is it becomes their action, and they change in the spiritual world in a way that they could never do for themselves. You hear what's going on here? So when you live your life out here, having lost somebody who's not here, you bear responsibility for their life now, more than you did before, in a way that you never did before. It's an incredible thing. It's a fantastic responsibility. And therefore, persons should do that. They should go through life consciously dedicating what they do to the memory of the inspiration that they got from this person. Definitely. And they should do special actions they wouldn't have done otherwise. And in the merit of doing those things, that person could be saved a tremendous amount of suffering. They could be elevated spiritually. Number two is davening.
When a person prays, you can daven, you can actually ask Hashem to save a person in the next world from suffering. I don't know if you're aware of that. And if you do it sincerely, you will affect what's happening to them. I'm not sure if you're aware of it. This is a very unusual thing. It says that, I don't want to go into too much detail, it says that if a parent has lost a child, then when the parent does certain actions in this world, it does not affect the child in the next world. Are you with me? But if a child has lost a parent in this world, are you with me? When the child does actions here, it does affect the parent. But there's one exception. I'm not going to go into the spiritual mechanism and reason. There's one exception, and that's davening. If you pray, you can affect anybody in the next world. The example is that when David lost his son, Absalom, remember? Absalom. So the pasuk says that David cried, he davened, he prayed for his son, and he said, Absalom b'ni, b'ni, b'ni Absalom, Absalom b'ni. And the pasuk uses the word my son 8 times. He said, when he was praying for his son, who is no longer in this world, he used the word my son 8 times. So the commentary, the Gemara says, it means this, that son had merited to sink to the 7th level of Gehenna. That means he was being punished in the dimension of retribution in the next world on the worst level imaginable. David said his name 7 times. Each time he said his name, he got him up 1 level and the 8th time into Gan Eden. You hear that? By the power of his tefillah. You hear that? Even though it was a son, who normally a parent doesn't merit in the next world. But by the power of his prayer, he absolutely... So you better get busy. A person has to daven, a Jewish woman has to daven. A Jewish woman has to pray. So doing it for them. Who else is remembering that person in this kind of acute way that could daven for them in this way? It's your obligation. You can affect them in that way, you have to do it. Are you with me? I don't want to take too long. Let's mention just maybe one other aspect that we touched on before. Maybe if there are questions, we can... There's a fortune to speak about, right? And that is simply this. Let's bring it down. That's the spiritual look at things, and that's what's happening in the next world, and that's the connection, that's the happiness of knowing that a person will be with that other person spiritually, that bond has never been severed. There's another issue, and that focuses on you. On you, on me right here and now. And that is getting busy, keeping busy. Apart from the benefit of what you do when you're busy, but being busy prevents depression. There's a mystical idea that the word in Hebrew for depression, which is atzvut, atzvut means depression, is almost the same. It's only one letter different from the word atzlut, which means non-activity, or laziness, or non-movement. And the Balei Musa has explained that one of the most potent causes of depression is when you grind to a halt, even physically. If you don't do anything, if you're still physically, the consequence is depression. You follow? If you're busy, it's hard to be depressed. The mystics define depression as spiritual non-activity. When a person is not moving spiritually, when you're not working on yourself, when you're not achieving spiritually, when you're not building yourself, you become depressed. That's an inevitable consequence. Your obligation in the world is to be moving spiritually. You have to be moving spiritually. You have to be working on yourself. The most potent way of working on yourself and the most potent way of keeping busy is to work on others, to do for other people. I know a woman who's got a serious illness. So her husband went to ask a godly in Yerushalayim what he should do for this woman, how he should protect her and cushion her in cotton wool, and how he should look after her. So this man said, tell her to keep busy doing for others. Isn't that amazing? That will fix her. If you mollycoddle her and look after her so she feels like she needs protection, she'll sink into a protected depression. You keep her busy, yes, that she must work for others and do and produce in the world, or she won't get depressed. And therefore, I mean, in a crude level, even people who have no spiritual conception know that the way to take somebody in an institution is depressed, they give them occupational therapy. And they make them weave baskets, anything to keep busy. They lie in their bed all day. You follow? And therefore, but a Jewish woman has to achieve greatness, not weave baskets. I mean, nothing wrong with weaving baskets. But you have to weave human neshama. A mother who has children in the world has to weave their lives, has to involve herself in their lives. Of children and grandchildren, in such a way that she's producing spiritual. The trick, of course, is that when a mother involves herself in her children and children-in-law's lives, she often makes them depressed. That's the problem. You have to know how to be involved. Yeah, that's a subtlety that you have to know. It doesn't mean being there all the time. Being involved in their lives means sometimes not being there. You have to know. But that's another discussion. How exactly to be involved in children and children-in-law's lives and grandchildren's lives in such a way. Yes, you have to know how to do it. You have to be able to tell them what to do and show them how to live, but you have to make them think that thought of it themselves. your father. Don't tell them what to do. They're not going to listen to that from you necessarily. So no, that's another discussion. And how to be involved in other people's. There's plenty of people in similar situations who can't cope. Do you know how many couples and singles there are in Berea and Yeovil and Hillbrow on starvation borderline? Do you know how many elderly Jews there are who are on borderline coping, and when they get flu or something they don't cope and they starve? Those people need help. They need somebody just to be human company, to go and take care of physical things, just to maintain a connection. At least somebody at the end of a phone when something desperate happens. And it's a life-saving work at a person. There's unfortunately no shortage of what needs to be done in the Jewish community, that people with maturity and experience in life and stability and balance and dignity and normality can do. And there's absolutely no justification for not getting involved in it. First of all, it's therapeutic and you have to do it. And secondly, people need it. And therefore, a person must look for those opportunities. Let me finish just with a story. Okay, can I do that? I'll finish just with a story. I'll tell you a story that I heard once, which is a fantastic story. You know, the basis of all this is the frustration of why we suffer in the world. Now, that's basically what it boils down to. These are ways of coping and understanding and making it better. So, but the bottom line remains that there's suffering. There is suffering in the world. And it's serious suffering and it's very painful. And the spiritual question that the greatest have asked is, why exactly do we have suffering in the world and what does it do? And we can't really answer that question fully. Now's not the time even to try. But I'll tell you a story that I heard, that at least if there's a positive side to it, this expresses it. This is a joke that I heard from a Kabbalist. A very amazing man in Jerusalem told me this joke. A great Kabbalistic mind, he was laughing so much when he told me this joke, he could hardly complete the story. This is a Kabbalist idea of a joke. Yeah? This is what he told me. He said the following thing, that there was a man, a chassid, who had tremendous trouble in life. Tzoros, all the time. So eventually he couldn't take it, so he went to his Rebbe, Hasidic Rebbe, and he said, Rebbe, why do I have so much tzoros? Why am I suffering so much in life? So the story is like this. The Rebbe took out his white hanky and he waved it in front of the chassid's eyes and he fell asleep. While he was sleeping, he had a dream. What was his dream? In his dream, he reached the end of his life. And he passed into the next world and he went through a certain gates over there, and they told him to go down a certain road in a certain direction. So he asked him, what's down the end of that road? So he said, it's a courtroom where your trial is taking place, your judgment. You're on trial and you go that way towards your... He started walking in trepidation down this road, and as he's walking down the road, suddenly the ground starts to shake and he hears an enormous rumble in the distance, and he turns around and he sees a long line of trucks. Black, big, enormous black trucks coming down the road. So he stops the driver in the first truck and he says, excuse me, where are you going? So the driver says, we're going to your trial. So he says to the driver, what have you got in all these trucks? So that all your avaras, all your sins. So he says to the driver, can you give me a lift? So the driver says, no, we've got no room in here. So he carries on walking down the road and his big black trucks pass him one after another, and can you imagine, he's feeling awful. Finally, they rumble off into the distance, and he's walking down this long, lonely road, wondering what's going to be. As he's walking along, he hears behind him a little high-pitched whine. He turns around, and bumping along the road is a little white car. So he stops the driver, and he says, where are you going? The driver says, I'm going to your trial. So he says, what have you got in that little car? So that's all your mitzvahs. So he says to the driver, can you give me a ride? So the driver says, sure, there's plenty of room in here. He gets in the car, and on the back seat, a little white bundle. A little white bundle on the back seat. So you can imagine how he's feeling. So they arrive at the courtroom, and the courtroom consists of an enormous pair of scales. And on the one side of the scales, they put all his avaris from these trucks. And on the other side, they put a little white packet. As they're about to put the little bundle on the scale, he hears another sound in the distance. And the ground rumbles, and another line of trucks arrives at the courtroom. So he says to the driver of these trucks, what have you got in these trucks? The driver says, all your tzoros. And they start piling all the tzoros onto the good side of the scale. Every little bit of trouble that he had, they start piling onto the side with a little white peckle. And finally, when they take the last bit of tzoros and they throw it on the scale, just balances exactly. So he says, Hashem, why didn't you give me more tzoros? So So it says in the mystical sources, first of all, you should know that anybody who does anything like that, the connection is potent. Even if it's an unconnected person who has to say Kaddish when a person doesn't have sons, let's say. Okay? The Kaddish does for that person incredible benefit. But if it's a student of a person, it says in the mystical sources that it's sometimes more powerful than a child. Because it says that when a person brings children into the world, he's responsible only for bringing them into this world. But when a person teaches somebody about Yiddishkeit, he brings him into the next world. And therefore there are times when the child has an obligation to his teacher before his parent. So on the contrary, if a person has the merit to have somebody that he taught and inspired in that way, that's the most potent connection. I want to mention one other fact that might be bothering some people, just on a practical level, and that is that spiritualism, I don't know if it affects the people here, but unfortunately there are many bereaved people in Johannesburg, certainly in the last few years, who have got involved in spiritualism. Specifically with a particular group, I'm not going to, certainly not the tape recorder is going to any specifics, of Jewish people, unfortunately, who offer to make a connection between you and the person who has no longer. Okay. You should know that from a Jewish point of view, it's completely and utterly forbidden. I'm not going to go into a whole lecture on it now, but it's forbidden, first of all. Secondly, it causes more problems than it causes spiritually. Thirdly, first of all, most of these people are not genuine at all. They are just people preying on bereaved minds. Okay, they're people who are trying to wield power and influence over others, or even money, earn money. And those who are genuine, and many of them, you get three categories: those who are not genuine at all, those who think they're genuine but aren't, but they're sincere about it, but they aren't genuine, and those who are genuine are able to have spiritualist type of connection. We certainly believe that it's a valid thing that can be done. No question about it. Even in the best case, namely those people who know how to do it, it's completely forbidden. And if you want just one idea, it causes tremendous pain to the neshama who's contacted. If you go to a medium and they're able to contact the spirit of somebody who's no longer alive, it causes them tremendous pain. Okay? We have a source written in Tanakh. When Saul went to the witch, you remember? Shaul went to the balas, he went to the witch and he asked her to contact the soul of Samuel or Shmuel. It says that when Shmuel heard his name, in the next world he thought he was being called to judgment and intrepidation. He brought Moshe Rabbeinu with him to protect him, to testify in his favor. And if Shmuel, a man of prophetic ability, was worried when he heard his name being called, can you imagine what most of us would experience? And therefore it causes tremendous pain. It's definitely not allowed. It causes horrendous damage in families. There are sources that say that it can cause bizarre tragedies in the family when a person's involved in spiritualism. I've been involved in a number, unfortunately. And therefore it's definitely forbidden. This one should definitely not even think about it. If you're interested in the subject further, I would suggest that we once had a discussion. I once made a recording of the mechanisms of how it works, astrology and spiritualism, what's allowed and what's not, and you can get a recording of that from Osamah. I think the tape is called Beyond Astrology. I think it's called Beyond Astrology because it talked to women, and there is a lengthy discussion of the whole mechanism of spiritualism and what's allowed, why it's not allowed, why a Jew is beyond that and so forth. One is certainly able to. While I'm talking about it, there are other tapes you can get from there which are relevant to this situation. I don't get any money from the tapes. The money goes just to maintaining the program so that they can keep the tapes going. But you will find there a tape called The Danger of a Fall, which is a discussion of what happens emotionally when a person takes a knock in life, how the consequence can be a much greater fall, and what one can do to use it as a positive experience, which I can't go into now. You can certainly take out that tape. And there are other tapes there that you might find interesting. There's one there that's called Ordeals. What it means, ordeals in life, and how one should deal with it. At least those three I would suggest. If you're interested in these subjects, I'm not offended if you don't listen to them. But if you do, you might find a lot more ideas connected to what we said. If there are any more questions, then I'll try to...